This is an ABC podcast.
This is the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
Hello, I'm Georgia Hargreaves, and a very big Happy New Year's to you. Good to have you here with me for the Country Hour. Hopefully you're not nursing a headache this afternoon. Now, China has just slapped a 55% tariff on any Australian beef over and above an existing quota of 200,000 tonnes per year. You'll hear details on that in the next half hour. And parts of northwest Queensland have had a lot of rain in the last week or so. One property has tipped out almost 950 mils from its rain gauge. The big fear now, of course, is livestock losses. So a bit later, you'll hear from our very experienced Queensland rural reporter, Maddie McCosker, for the latest update. 12:06 on the Country Hour this afternoon. And the WA government's permanent ban on commercial demersal fishing from Augusta to Kalbarri comes into effect today in a move it says will help protect several species of fish. Fisherman Nicholas Soulos has worked in the industry for over 55 years, but as of today, his licence is cancelled and he says he's got no idea what he and his crew will do now.
It's a complete wipeout for us. Where our licence is going to be permanently cancelled. We stop fishing, pack up, and it'll be at least 7 months before we see any form of financial assistance or compensation. And even that looks very grim given the amount that they've budgeted for. And I don't know where we go. We're still trying to assess the situation.
How often are you guys out on the water and how much will your daily routine change for not only yourself but also the people who work for you guys?
Fishing's a life. I've lived and breathed this fishery for over 55 years. The skipper, who's been skippering the boat now for 30-odd years, he lives and breathes it. The two crew that we have, they came to us as teenagers. They're now in their early 50s. It's the only occupation they know. It's the only skill they know. And they're very good at it too, I'll give you. They're very professional in what they do and their operation. But this has completely blindsided everyone. It's like waking up on the 1st of January and saying, our career, our business is finished, never to come back again. This is not a pause. This is a permanent cancellation forever. The people whose livelihoods they're wrecking, they have not come and spoken to us before the announcement or since the announcement. I asked for some emergency funding for the skipper and crews of the boat so they can enjoy Christmas and be able to pay their mortgages come the middle of January and pay their rent come the first week in January. And the government's not coming to the party with any of that. What they forget is that we've got no cash flow. Our cash flow gets cut off on the 1st of January. We're not going to have the funds or the resources to even help ourselves, let alone the crew and the skipper. I think it's been handled very poorly. There's been no respect for the fishermen whatsoever. Other states have handled it far better than this. There's been similar closures. In Queensland's a prime example on the Great Barrier Reef. Their management plan, they had a lot of respect for the fishermen. The fishermen were able to exit the fishery with dignity. We don't get any of that. And they had a decent, fair compensation package, which the one that the government's suggesting doesn't come anywhere near being appropriate for what they're trying to do.
Well, the government says that science shows that some of these stock levels are dangerously low. What's your response to the science that they're backing?
Look, two things. Firstly, what we are seeing out on the water doesn't reflect what the science is telling us. So there's a disconnect there somewhere. There's something isn't right, and we're asking for that to be looked into. The other thing is, yes, they are at bad levels, but I mean, when the commercial fishermen aren't the cause of those levels going down to where they are. It's a pure numbers game. It's the pure volume of the recreational fishers, coupled with very bad management decisions from the government on how to handle the recreational side of the fishery. What we're pushing for now is for the government to come to the table and discuss these things with us, because yes, we don't want to see a permanent closure of the fishery. It's a sustainable fishery. If it's managed correctly, and there are some very good management measures that the demersal gillnet fishery can put into place so it doesn't impact the scale fish, even though our catch is very minor, we can even reduce it further with some manipulations of the management plan to get the desired outcome. It's just a matter of the government coming to the table and talking with us and discussing the issues, which they haven't done.
Third-generation Bunbury fisherman Nicholas Soulos, he was speaking with Rachel Boothman. And I'm keen to hear your thoughts on this afternoon, particularly if this is something directly impacting you. 0448 922 604 is the text line. Let me know how you're faring and what you make of what you've just heard. It's 11 past 12. If you're just tuning in, I'm Georgia Hargreaves, and this is the WA Country Hour. And we're talking about the permanent closure of commercial demersal fishing from Kalbarri down to Augusta, and that ban comes into effect today. Melissa Haslam is the CEO of the WA Fishing Industry Council, who represent commercial fishers. She's been trying to get a meeting with WA Premier Roger Cook to discuss options for the future, but despite the ban coming into effect today, she's heard nothing back.
This is a big day for the fishermen. We were really hoping that we would have heard from the Premier and had the opportunity to speak to the Premier. We have put open letters in the newspaper asking for that. We have written privately. All we want to do is talk about options for the future, and our fishermen have been completely ignored.
So let's play devil's advocate here. If the government believes that jewfish and pink snapper, for example, as fish species, are on the brink of a collapse, why isn't a complete ban for the moment the right decision?
We were expecting some closures and we were expecting some bans. But what we weren't expecting was for commercial fishers to be stopped forever. I mean, that's the bit that's very, very different. We were definitely under the impression that there would be some closures, some recovery period, and then the fishery would be reopened at some point in the future once the stocks had recovered. And we thought that we would be a part of a shared solution with the recreational sector. What we weren't expecting is after just 2 years, the recs are allowed to have at it and commercials are closed forever. That is an extraordinary stance to take, and it's certainly not one that was backed by any science. And nobody from the Premier's office has contacted us to even have a conversation about where that came from or how that's going to affect the commercial fishers and that whole supply chain, including the consumers at the end. All we've heard the Premier say is this was a very difficult decision to make, no doubt made a lot easier by the fact he's never actually spoken to anybody.
WAFIC CEO Melissa Haslam, she was speaking to Clint Wheeldon on ABC Breakfast this morning. Now, in response, a state government spokesperson said in a statement, the reforms are based on scientific assessments that were independently reviewed and followed extensive consultation. The Fisheries Minister has been actively engaging with all sectors of the fishing community throughout this process, including the WA Fishing Industry Council. The statement goes on to say the state government is working to roll out the support package measures as quickly as possible and is aiming to provide active grace payments to commercial fishers in January to expedite the formal buyout of licences. If you're interested, you can read more on this story on the ABC News website. Just search ABC News and Fishing. 12:15. You're listening to The Country Hour this afternoon. Now, China has just slapped a 55% tariff on any Australian beef over and above an existing quota of 200,000 tonnes per year. Australian Meat Industry Council Chief Executive Officer Tim Ryan believes that these new restrictive trade agreements could cost industry about $1 billion in the next year, unless new markets can be found.
Yeah, it certainly is a disappointing outcome to hear the news overnight. China's effectively decided to implement a regime of import quotas to supplying nations such as Australia. This will ultimately limit the volume of beef we can ship into the market in 2026 and over the next 3 years.
And it's about the amount of beef over an existing quota. So why is that a problem?
Yeah, so Australia has been allocated about 200,000 tonnes of access into the market. That will be tariff-free. But once we trigger that volume, we'll have to pay a 55% tariff, which will be prohibitive going forward. So effectively, it means a 200,000-tonne cap on what we can trade. If you compare that to recent trade performance over the last 12 months, we've shipped over a little bit over 300,000 tonnes. So we're kind of going or losing about a third of our current trade into China.
And what will this mean in terms of where China gets their beef from? Are they going to get it from South America?
Yeah, and South America is certainly the dominant player in the market. About 80% of beef currently imported into China comes from South America. We account for about 8%. So we certainly are a minor player, but we play an important role, and particularly from our side, China's very important for us. It's currently our second largest export market, taking around 17% of our overall exports.
And is there any way of getting around this, or might they change their mind? Because, I mean, I understand Australian beef is very popular in China.
Yeah, and that's the case we've been making throughout this year-long investigation China's been through. The decision they've taken is in response to the domestic industry lobbying that they've been affected by imports. We've pushed strongly that Australia hasn't necessarily been the cause of any damage to their domestic industry. And as you say, our beef is extremely popular. Chinese consumers have developed a long preference for Australian beef. We've been in the market for a very long time and would like to continue to do so. Ultimately, once we hit our quota allocation for the year, we'll have to redivert that trade elsewhere.
And I've been to China and I've seen the domestic product versus the Australian product. And this, you're not comparing apples with apples, are you, with the quality-wise?
No, certainly not. And we play an important role in the market, and particularly some of those premium segments. The type of beef we produce is quite different. We can do grain and grass and chilled and frozen, and we ultimately complement the domestic industry. We are, at the end of the day, a drop in the ocean in the overall meat complex in China.
Now, you put a dollar figure on this of potentially a $1 billion hit to the industry. How do you get to that figure?
Yeah, certainly. If you look at that recent trade performance, so the last 12 months we've done about 300,000 tonnes. We'll have to go back to around 200,000 tonnes this year based on these quota restrictions. If you put a value on that amount of tonnage, it's a bit over $1 billion. So that trade will have
per annum.
So that trade will then be redirected to alternative export markets and some of it come back to the domestic market as well.
But you may not get the premium price for it if you send it to Southeast Asia, for example.
And that's certainly the important role China plays in our overall export portfolio. So we'll always be able to sell our beef, and the world loves our beef, but the next best option to China won't necessarily pay the same price.
So are we going to see a reduction in the price for cattle at the sale yards, or that's a long bow?
It's difficult to anticipate how markets will react, and certainly immediately we'll continue to trade with China. This market's not going to disappear, certainly not in the short term. And when we hit quota, that's probably going to be mid-year in 6 or 7 months' time. But there's a lot of other factors that impact price, and this is one of many. But certainly if you see our second largest beef export market dry up at some point in 2026, it will feed through to that pricing complex.
So where to from here? I mean, are we going to get the trade experts out and talking to China again, or maybe change the regulations or special dispensation for Australian beef maybe in China?
Yeah, we'll certainly continue to push for that. That's been the case that we've made at an industry and government level throughout this investigation over the last 12 months and asked for special treatment at the end of the day. We don't think we're the problem, so we don't think necessarily we need to be captured by these new trade measures.
And we can't just sort of send more beef into the US, for example?
We'll probably do some of that. The US market is very strong at the moment. You can always sell into the US trim market, but it's the premiums you lose along the way in rediverting those cuts. So we're never going to be short of a buyer. We sell into over 100 export markets around the world. The challenge is the value that is lost when you have to redirect trade.
What's happening with the EU then? Is that a possible market we could ship some of this excess beef into out of China?
We would love to do more trade into the EU, and there's currently the FTA negotiations that are underway at the moment. So this just really reinforces the need for good access into as many markets as possible. And I think it really highlights the fact that we need a really good outcome for beef and all red meat in these current EU negotiations underway at the moment.
Australian Meat Industry Council CEO Tim Ryan, he was talking to Michael Condon. Now, this morning, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese was asked if he had any forewarning about these new tariffs on Australian beef going to China.
We are communicating with our counterparts. This is something that wasn't Australia being singled out. This is a general position that China has put. We are advocating, as we always do, for Australian industry.
What sort of an impact do you expect it's going to have on the industry?
Well, we, of course, this is an announcement that is across the board, so it doesn't impact Australia, isn't being singled out here. Australian beef is, in my view, proudly, as the Australian Prime Minister, the best in the world. We compete in the world very well, and our products are in great demand right around the world. We expect that will continue to be so. The Australian beef industry has never been stronger than it is today as we enter 2026.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese. Now, leader of the Nationals, David Littleproud, says he is extremely disappointed for the cattle industry, and he's calling on the Prime Minister and Trade Minister to make urgent representations to their counterparts in Beijing. Independent meat and livestock analyst Simon Quilty thinks the tariffs will affect the top end of Australia's beef, especially in the later half of this year.
It's deeply disappointing, but the real concern lies with, I think, the quality end of the market. So chilled beef programs, this is really disruptive to it because the chances are we're likely to hit that safeguard sometime in May or June. And that's in part due to what we call the rush to the door effect, Annie, where exporters will try to get the benefits early, because it's on a first-in, first-serve basis. And so you then tend to fill these quotas or safeguards quickly. And then suddenly for the back end of the year, you've got a 55% tariff in place, and it's extremely difficult to put a chilled beef program in place to ship consistently through the year when it becomes cost prohibitive in the back end of the year. So it's that quality end of the market. It's chilled. It will be both grass-fed and grain-fed, but I think grain-fed in particular will be the one, I think, hit the most.
So do you think we're likely to see, I guess, I don't know, like a pile of chilled beef at the end of the year looking for a new market?
No, I think, you know, the market will look to allocate resources earlier than that. So it will be a matter of just finding new homes. But the problem then becomes that we're not the only one in this situation. You've got Brazil, who this year, in 2025, shipped near on 1.6 million tonnes, and they've suddenly been drawn back to a 1.1 million allocation. So there's 500,000 tonnes that in 2026 will have to find a new home from Brazil. We look at Argentina, it's a similar story. There's 50,000 tonnes that will need to find a new home. And from an Australian point of view, I think it's closer to probably 50,000 to 60,000 tonnes that needs to find a new home. So we're all out there at the same time, and if you add that up, Annie, that's 600,000 tonnes globally that needs to find a new home. So not only is it disruptive to the flow of chilled and other products, but then when you go to find other markets, you're now competing with more beef because others are impacted in the same way.
Independent meat and livestock analyst Simon Quilty there speaking to Annie Brown. 25 past 12 on the Country Hour this afternoon. I've got a couple of texts that have come through regarding the demersal fishing ban, which comes into effect today. This text in from Brian in Tenterden. He says, I believe the best way to improve fish stock numbers is to limit the use of electronic devices, ban them on recreational vessels, and limit their use on professional commercial vessels. It's not the pros that flaunt the rules and regulations. Thank you for that text. And this another text, Steve from Mount Barker, says we can now expect more nighttime visits from foreign boats from Kalbarri on down. Thank you for sharing your thoughts. 0448 922 604 is the number if you'd like to get in touch.
The WA Country Hour with Georgia Hargreaves on ABC Radio WA.
Now, farming waste may soon be used to create furniture and build houses. Waste from crops, including hemp, corn, rice, and sugarcane, is being used, is being tested to become renewable material for use in furniture and houses rather than being burned or discarded. Research fellow with the University of Melbourne, Dr. Benoit Belleville, says the results so far are promising.
We've been looking at different applications, not only furniture, but also looking at building products. And with some testing, we have some very promising results when it comes to acoustic properties, sound absorption properties, also insulation. So these crops have lower densities than you would see for timber, for example. So this can be an advantage where we can use them for different applications in your house. This can also be used for furniture applications. We've done some combinations of different materials using industrial hemp, but also the corn stalk to fabricate some cores for panels, which we can then laminate with different veneers or other materials, depending on the end application and the end use.
So is it difficult to turn these farm waste substances, the corn, the hemp, into the right, I guess, resources to make this furniture? Is it a difficult process?
Well, what we do, so obviously we go to the field once the crops have been harvested. So for example, for industrial hemp, this is essentially grown to produce seeds, which will then be used to produce oil and other pharmaceutical products. Then we have the rest of the plant, the stalk, the herd, which we break down into smaller particles, smaller bits, and we do an assessment of those of that raw material. We control, obviously, moisture in it. We assess it based on the different provenances, where it comes from. And once we break it down into some smaller, manageable fractions, particles, we can then mix them with different binders or glues, if you prefer, to produce panels for various applications.
And in, as you said, a few different uses you've trialed, were any of them more successful than the others?
Well, we've been able to produce some good particle boards. So these are panel products. This panel can then be used for multiple applications in your house, in buildings. But yeah, we've done some good trials to fabricate panels, and we also have we're working with our partners to develop some end users for them at the moment as we speak.
So you've essentially proved it's possible. Is it going to be commercially viable? Is this something that Australians might see more often in the coming years?
Well, it's hard to put a time frame on this. So obviously, we need to do a bit more research. We're looking at improving the different properties, finding the right recipes, if I can say. So yes, there's a bit more research that needs to be done, but we have some very promising results, and this is something we're doing with our partners, so trying to go from the laboratory to a manufacturing process, also scaling it up. There is obviously some research that needs to be done, but what we get in our lab is very promising. So hopefully fairly soon we'll see some of those products in different markets.
Pretty cool idea, isn't it? That was Dr. Benoit Belleville from the University of Melbourne speaking with Elsie Adamo about the research he's doing on turning crop waste into valuable building materials. It's 12:30. Kelsey Reid is here in the Karratha studio with the news headlines. Kelsey, hello.
Hello, Georgia. Australian exports of beef to China may eventually cease following new tariffs announced by Beijing. The 55% tariff will apply to any beef products that exceeds quota levels. China has set its import quota at 2.7 million metric tons, which will apply for the next 3 years. CEO of Australian Meat Industry Council, Tim Ryan, says it's unsustainable and he expects they will utilise the allocation of the quota within 6 to 8 months. The local government minister, Hannah Beasley, says WA's first local government inspector has a lot to do as he commences his work. From today, Tony Brown will be able to put a stop to any early signs of chaos or dysfunction in local government. He'll be able to send in monitors to any council, investigate complaints, issue fines, and recommend the suspension or dismissal of individual councillors and entire councils. In 2025, two local councils were replaced by commissioners and a third narrowly avoided suspension. Firefighters are tackling a blaze on the state's south coast, started by fireworks set off by New Year's Eve revellers. A bushfire advice is currently in place for eastern parts of Cape Legrand National Park, including the Wharton Beach area in the Shire of Esperance. While the fire is not controlled or contained, authorities say it does not currently pose a threat to lives or homes. It was reported just after midnight at Victoria Harbour Beach, about 100 kilometres east of Esperance. Also making news, a raft of new restrictions for demersal fishing in WA have come into effect. Commercial fishing of demersal fish will no longer be allowed on the West Coast bioregion, which includes a 900-kilometre stretch of coast from Augusta to Kalbarri. The state government introduced the measures to help improve the numbers of at-risk species like jewfish and pink snapper. A permanent ban on demersal trawling also starts in the Pilbara, with two seafood companies challenging that decision in the Supreme Court. That's all for now. For news anytime, visit our website, abc.net.au, or tune in at 1 p.m.
Thank you, Kelsey. It is 28 to 1. Let's head to the Bureau of Meteorology. Caroline Crowe is here with us today. Let's start in the north of the state again, Caroline. What's on the radar for the northern and eastern forecast districts?
Yeah, good afternoon and happy new year. The remnants of ex-tropical cyclone Hayley, the tropical low is still lingering through eastern central parts of the Kimberley. There was some heavy rainfall the system brought through those areas yesterday and overnight last night. It has eased off a little bit at the moment and is continuing to weaken, but still looking at showers and thunderstorms developing again through that area with the chance of a localised heavy fall. The tropical low, or the low, the weakening low, will move gradually towards the northeast, and sort of by Friday, it's looking as being mostly in the NT region through that area there, and then we're returning more to the typical seasonal showers and thunderstorms throughout the Kimberley from tomorrow onwards through the forecast period. For today, though, away from that eastern part of the Kimberley, the remaining parts of the Kimberley are still isolated showers and thunderstorms possible, and then extending through into the Pilbara, getting into most parts of the Gascoyne, most of the interior, and also far northern parts of the goldfields today. As you move away from the Kimberley and just the adjacent areas, little or no rainfall really with any of those thunderstorms that do form further south. There is a slight chance of also getting I was going to go into the Southwest Land Division, but I'll just hold off on that part and we'll continue with the north. So remaining parts of those southeastern parts, so the Eucla, the rest of the Goldfields, is pretty looking clear of weather today. And then what we're going to see is gradually that trough does move inland a little bit coming into Friday. So those thunderstorms do move a little bit further inland from our west coastal part. So very similar area that I said just before for today, though extending a little bit further south into the goldfields and throughout the interior. And western parts of the Pilbara and western parts of the Gascoyne likely to be clear of thunderstorms. So a little bit further inland. And then once again, still a similar area coming into Saturday, though we do get a ridge pushing up, which pushes the thunderstorms up a little bit further north. So by Saturday, showers and thunderstorms confined to the Kimberley, the north interior, the central and eastern parts of the Pilbara, the northeast Gascoyne, and just getting into the goldfields. But then as we progress back into Sunday and Monday, that trough does move back towards the west coast. So we see those thunderstorms move back towards the west coast, but clear through most parts of the interior section. So for Sunday and Monday, through the Kimberley, the Pilbara, the north interior, the Gascoyne, and getting into the goldfields, the western parts for Monday. As we're getting some warming temperatures over the week as well through central part, mostly through those central and southern parts of the state. So as we progress into the weekend and getting into Sunday, Monday, the trough really does deepen and we get some good northeasterly winds and that heat pushing through central parts of the state. So coming in, we're going to see a gradual increase in those temperatures for central parts. So Meekatharra through northern parts of the goldfields, Kalgoorlie, all that area through there and even right down to the south coast, but gradual increase. So but tomorrow sort of 40 degrees. By Sunday, 43 degrees for the northern goldfields and Meekatharra area and getting right about up to 45 degrees for the northern goldfields and Meekatharra area by Monday. And even Kalgoorlie, I think, is potentially getting into the low to mid-40s around that time as well. So we do have a heat wave warning that has been issued coming into later on in the week and into the weekend with those high maximum temperatures and those minimum temperatures overnight will start warming up as well. So just keep a watch out for that heatwave warning as well for those areas.
Thank you, Caroline. And how about the Southwest Land Division? What can we expect?
Yeah, so for the Southwest Land Division for today, with the trough within the vicinity near the west coast, the thunderstorms could just creep into those far northeastern parts, so mostly inland parts of the central west district, and then possibly may also see a thunderstorm just in the southwest corner at the base of the trough. So inland from Albany and inland from the Walpole area and Bunbury, just in a little pocket through that area there. Not too much rainfall or little or no rainfall with the thunderstorms expected through today in the Southwest Land Division, just in those places that I did mention. As we progress into Friday, the thunderstorms do contract further northeast and just should generally be to the northeast of the Southwest Land Division or may just creep into that far northeastern part, so even northeast of the Southern Cross area there. So just a very, very small little area for the Southwest Land Division. And then we start the trough pushes further north and Saturday, no thunderstorms expected through the Southwest Land Division. But then we do start to see them creep back in coming into Sunday and Monday as that trough moves back towards the west coast and extends further south as well. So on Sunday, inland parts of the central west could see some thunderstorms and then it extends further south, though inland parts. So from that inland central west region, we see it extend into the central wheat belt, getting into northern and eastern parts of the Great Southern and possibly even creeping into northern parts of the southeast coastal district and then sort of that southwest corner from probably around the Lancelin area through to Hopetoun or Bremer Bay area. Southwest of that line is should be clear of thunderstorms. We'll also see some warming temperatures through the Southwest Land Division as the week progresses, particularly through those inland parts getting into 40 to 41 degrees tomorrow for inland northern parts, getting and then gradually increasing to potentially into the low 40s, 42 to 44 degrees through inland northern parts of the Southwest Land Division, getting into the central wheat belt. Great Southern's looking at sort of getting into high 30s, and even inland parts of the Southeast Coastal District getting into the high 30s as well.
Thank you for the update, Caroline. It is 21 to 1. Richard Hudson, can you run us through the rainfall totals?
Yeah, most of the action, as you'd imagine, is in the Kimberley again, and some big totals and some not so big totals. Bedford Downs had 101 mils, Ellenbrae 6, Doongan, Faraway Bay, Fitzroy Crossing and Halls Creek only had 5 mils, Kachana 23, Kalumburu 17, Kununurra's Checkpoint had 98 mils, and just down the road at the Deepherd Station, 0.4 of a mil. Lansdowne had 182, Marion Downs 22, Moolabulla Airstrip had 8, Mount Amherst 14, Mount Winifred 11, Nicholson 51, Old Mornington Homestead 24, Yulumbu had 41, and in the Pilbara, Winning had 35 mils, and apart from that, nowhere had even a single drop. A bushfire watch and act is still in place in the city of Kalamunda. So that's in for those in parts of Maidervale, Forestfield and Kalamunda. If you want the latest on that one, I've been talking about it all day, just search emergency in WA. That warning is at the top of the page, and a 19-year-old has been charged over starting that fire. He's due to face court today. A total fire ban has been declared for today for the following shires: Boddington, Chittering, Collie, Dardanup, Gosnells, Harvey, Katanning, Kojonup, Mundaring, Murray, Northam, Serpentine, Jarrodale, City of Swan, 2J, Wagen, Waroona and Woodnilling. So you can't do anything that could start a fire. If you need more details on that, just again, search emergency in WA on the website. It's on the website, a bit harder to find on the app. And you'll see which shires have a total fire ban and what you can and can't do when a total fire ban's in place. And due to the risk of fire, a few shires have officially got a harvest ban in place. They've notified us, Broomhill Tambalup Shire and also Yilgarn, but it's generally regarded as a day when harvesting is not such a good idea. So if you're thinking about it, maybe just check with your local shire first. But just getting back to rains, Georgia, it certainly, I mean, I know it's rained a fair bit in the Kimberley, but you reckon those totals are big. It just keeps raining in parts of Queensland. There's now significant flooding in some parts of north and the northwest. Queensland Rural reporter Maddie McCosker is right across what's going on. Maddie, what's the latest?
Yeah, hi Richard. Look, this severe weather that we've had across North Queensland is starting to ease gradually, but floodwaters are expected to peak across the northwest in the coming days. There's still a lot of water to move through these systems, and as a result, communities have been cut off for over a week now, and dozens of roads have been closed while that water does move through. And as the rain and intense wind eases, graziers have just in the last few days been able to get out and up in choppers as well to assess their properties for stock losses. But at this stage, the full extent of the impact and the damage caused by this flooding is still unclear. The Department of Primary Industries here in Queensland says it could be days before we get any real idea of what we're dealing with.
Which area has been worst hit?
Yeah, look, it's hard to say if there's been an area that's been worse hit than others, because this system just kind of sat over such a large part of the northwest for over a week. And areas like Normanton in the Gulf were hit with really big rainfall totals early on. And that rain has eased in the last few days, but they're still dealing with huge amounts of floodwaters, with plenty more coming their way. And this event turned tragic on Tuesday when a man was found dead in his car in floodwaters just outside of Normanton on Tuesday. And emergency services are reminding people that, you know, stay out of these floodwaters. Don't drive through them. It's not safe. So, yeah, a really tragic turn there earlier in the week. And as this system was moving south throughout the week, areas around Julia Creek and Cloncurry, McKinlay also saw huge rainfall totals. one property near Cloncurry measured 945 millimetres since the 23rd of December, which is almost 38 inches in the old measurements, and they typically see 21 inches in a year. So just massive amounts of rain.
That is huge, especially for the sort of country that you're talking about, because it's relatively flat, isn't it?
Absolutely. In the northwest, it is really flat country. So the floodwaters can be quite slow moving. And that is just a lot of water. You know, the creeks and the rivers are already so swollen. The channels as well have so much water in them. They just really can't take any more.
And hardly anywhere for it to go. But it has rained a fair bit in Queensland's tropical north too, hasn't it?
It has, yes. And you know, I will say that it is wet season here in the north, in northern Australia. So this is fairly typical to be seeing these kind of big falls. But particularly in northern Queensland, that country copes a lot better with these big rains. It's, you know, they're kind of used to these kind of numbers, although it is still quite early in the wet season. So to be getting more than a metre of rain this early on has some people concerned about what's to come for the rest of the wet season.
Yeah, the country there is very different. It has the undulations and it has some of the hard surfaces and the river systems, etc., and things just sort of channel out towards the ocean. Although, well, I'm sure there could still be some short-term pain for some of the farmers in that area. But for the ones in more your part of the world, more in the north and the northwest of Queensland, which are not so used to these big falls, what's the biggest danger from here on in, apart from an inconvenience?
Yeah, look, it's just a wait and see game at the moment for a lot of people in the northwest. You know, while that the rain is easing and it's moving south, there's still so much floodwaters moving through those systems, and there's more rises expected in the coming days. It's just the country is so incredibly drenched at the moment. Everyone's really hoping for a break in the weather and some much needed sun to dry things out. And I guess the main concern at the moment now is for livestock losses. And as I said earlier, it's still quite unclear what we're dealing with in that space. Initially, there was a lot of concern that this would be really similar to the events of 2019, which was a catastrophic flooding event that is still so fresh in the minds of a lot of people in the northwest. More than 500,000 head of livestock perished in that event. And while this event has unfolded in a similar way, there were differences as well. You know, people said early December rain will have helped cattle gain strength and some condition, so they were able to deal with the flooding a little bit better than 2019 when they'd just come off a years-long drought. There also wasn't the cold temperatures and the wind chill. While there was intense wind, it wasn't as cold as what we saw in 2019. And, you know, the older cattle would be able to deal with that quite well. But Libby Harriman, who's a vet at Hughenden, said that there are still fears for young cattle and calves in particular.
Yeah, so like at this stage, I don't think, I'm praying that it's not going to be as catastrophic as 2019. It's not quite as cold as it was in 19. And at this stage, it looks like the water is going to run away quicker. Most of the adult cattle that perished in 19 died from exposure. So they sat around and shivered in cold, wet conditions for, you know, days on end. And when, you know, when they walked away, some walked away and some didn't. And the ones that were sort of under the pile of animals or, you know, suffered from the cold were the ones that succumbed to the conditions. You know, right now it's not quite that cold, so we're not seeing, you know, as many animals huddling together. A lot of producers have put in some high ground since 19, so the cattle can actually get out of the water. But, you know, as I said, you know, a lot of cattle are calving at the moment, so those young calves, they haven't got the body mass to stay warm. And if they can't get, you know, get to high ground, you know, they're going to freeze and die, unfortunately.
Not a nice aspect of the job, is it, Maddie? It's a vet, Libby Harriman from Hughenden, but dealing with those sorts of deaths. We gloss over figures quickly. 500,000 head of livestock, you mentioned, perished in 2019. That is huge. And let's just hope you're not heading towards that case this time. But from what she's saying, if the temperatures aren't so low, then maybe you might escape.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a lot of people in the northwest are just really hoping that because it wasn't – quite as cold, and some areas escaped that windy factor as well, that, you know, we won't be seeing figures quite that high. People are getting out and about today in choppers. I was talking to someone earlier who said, you know, they had a pilot up and about moving cattle, swimming them through paddocks, getting them to higher ground yesterday. So, you know, as people do get out and about in the next day or so, we're going to get a better idea of what we're dealing with. But from all accounts, from what we're hearing, it's just still too early to really know what the situation is.
Let's hope it stops raining. Just out of interest, any idea if any of that flooding is going to make its way into some of the other river systems, like has happened in the past, where it even finds its way into New South Wales, finds its way into even South Australia?
Yeah, so it's actually really interesting looking at where the water flows to in the systems across Queensland. So in the Gulf, the areas sort of north of Mount Isa and around to Normanton, that water flows into the Gulf country and flows north into the ocean, basically. Anything south of that area flows down into all the river systems through Western Queensland, and eventually a lot of that water will end up in Lake Eyre Basin.
It's wild, isn't it? We've got a big country, but we're connected by water.
Yeah, it's amazing to see a visual map of just where it starts and where it ends up in the end. It's pretty unbelievable.
Our hopes are with all of the people there. Let's hope we don't lose as many livestock as last time. But Maddie, thanks for your time on the WA Country Hour, and stay safe yourself.
Thanks so much, Richard.
Yes, thank you to Longreach-based rural reporter Maddie McCosker. Now, Ashley Gallagher is on Sawtell Creek Station in northwest Queensland near Normanton. It's well and truly flooded, but they have managed to get a chopper out to move cattle to higher ground.
Well, we're still surrounded by floodwaters. They've just not going up as fast anymore. Like, they're just very, very slowly. It's only risen like 4 centimetres in the last 12 hours, so pretty steady in that way, but still a lot of water around. Luckily, there's a couple of helicopters on the ground now, and we've shifted a lot of cattle out to higher ground.
Do you have any idea of losses at this point?
No, not really. We did come across a cow floating down the river near Normanton. There's still a chance that she might find high ground somewhere, but that's probably one that you can write off. Like, with a bit of luck, most of them got out. Yeah, like most of them. Good old Brahman cattle, they know how to swim and they know how to survive. So they, some of them, the pilot was saying yesterday that some of them would actually have a bit of a rest up against a tree and just lay there and float for a while, and then they'd pick their way through and keep going. He was pretty confident that most of them got out.
Yeah. Oh.
He did have an incident with some cattle that I'll tell you about. He went to shift some cows off a ridge. When they walked into the water, there was a hell of a commotion and they all shot back under the helicopter, and he said there was four big salties laying in the water, laying in wait. So he actually just left those ones on that little island.
That was Ashley Gallagher from Sawtell Creek Station near Normanton over in Queensland. He was speaking with Hannah Walsh. And Normanton, if you're wondering, is in northwest Queensland, and it's about 1,640 kilometres northwest of Brisbane. 8 minutes to one, you're tuned in to the Country Hour this afternoon on ABC Local Radio. And now that 2026 is upon us, I wonder if a change of scenery is on the cards for you this year. Well, that's certainly the case for 23-year-old Harry Pitkin. Originally from northeastern Arnhem Land in the Northern Territory, Harry is now based in Karratha as a sparky. He's also worked on a cattle station in Queensland, and this year he's heading to Canada to work on a ranch in the snow.
I've been dreaming it for a few years now. I don't know, me and my brother were supposed to do it a couple of years back, but obviously life got in the way. But now I'm living in Karratha, I'm making the money that I want to be making, and it's getting me there a lot faster. I don't really know why we chose to go to Canada. I think we sort of jumped on the mainstream. There's a lot of young people going to Canada at the moment, but yeah, I've always liked the country out in Canada. Not so much the ski fields, but everything else Canada's got to offer.
And what do you hope to do over there in Canada?
I'm planning to do a fair bit of my cattle ranch work. I've got a fair bit of work lined up just outside of Alberta. And, I reckon that'd be pretty damn cool.
And what are you picturing in terms of the scenery over there? Because I imagine going from working on stations in Queensland, it'd be pretty different in Canada.
Yeah, bloody oath. I reckon big old mountains and those big streams, and I know it'd be pretty sick to ride horses through snow, I reckon. That'd be wild. But yeah, it'd be a big adjustment coming from North Queensland, going from pretty damn hot in the high 30s with a shitload of humidity. Sorry, I don't know if I'm allowed to swear, but yeah, going from the high humidity, yeah, all the way to negative 30s in the winter, that'd be pretty harsh, I reckon.
Yeah, it'd be a huge sea change. So you did spend some time working on a station in Queensland. Can you tell me a bit about where you worked?
So I was in, it's about 400 k's from Townsville and about 500 k's from Cairns, close towards the Gulf of Carpentaria, on a little station just out of town called Winesley. It was called Red Rock Station, the station I was at. It's only a little property, family owned, family ran, about 57,000 acres.
And how long did you spend working there?
I was there for nearly 2 years, about 18 months. It was a shame to leave, but yeah, there's money to be made over here in Karratha, in the Pilbara.
And what did you learn while working on the station? What did it teach you?
Oh, I can't tell you how much it taught me. It was probably the best thing for me as a young fella. The list is just, yeah, too big to say. Like, just your life skills and, yeah, going in there, you don't really know what you're doing too much, but, yeah, you come out of it with just more of a better knowledge of yourself, and I recommend any young fella go and do it. It was the best experience I ever did.
I want to know, you've also done some bull riding in the Northern Territory and in Queensland. How on earth did that come all about?
Came about even before I was out in the station. I had some friends over in Darwin, and yeah, we just started jumping on their bulls at their place, and yeah, fell in love with it. Never went too well, but I think it's just more of the adrenaline rush for me, and couldn't get enough of it. And God, I started getting a bit older, and it started hurting a little bit more. And I rode a few more times in North Queensland, but yeah, I don't think I was good enough, and I didn't have the commitment to keep going with it. But it was bloody fun while it lasted. I left right at the right time before I got too hurt.
How old were you when you first got on a bull then?
Oh, I think I would have been maybe just 17, 18.
Wow. And what did your mum say when you came on and told her you'd been on a bull?
Oh, I didn't tell mum I was jumping on a bull. She knew straight away when I walked through that door with my big old limp. And she said, "You bloody idiot."
If you're just tuning in, this is the WA Country Hour. I'm chatting to Harry Pitkin. He's a Sparky in Karratha now, but he's done a lot in his life, as you'll hear. So I want to know, just on the topic of bull riding, what actually goes through your mind just before you're about to jump on one? What are you thinking?
Not much, really, other than just that beast, and you're just trying to keep yourself composed, and it's a fairly big mental challenge, a lot bigger than people think. But yeah, you're not really thinking about much else other than you and that bull and trying to give it your all, but yeah, it's pretty mentally draining.
So you grew up in a place called Gove over in the Northern Territory. That's in East Arnhem Land.
Northeast Arnhem Land.
Yeah. So what was it like growing up in Gove?
It was a pretty damn remote community. I think we were about 700 k's from the nearest big town, which was Katherine. But there were obviously a heap of little outstations, communities in between. You still had the bush and still had some of the best fishing. Yeah, you could go 20 k's offshore and fill up your esky full of cold trout and go 30 k's down the road and, yeah, go smash 20 barra. Yeah, it was a bloody awesome place to grow up. And plenty of freedom. Yeah, it was an awesome place.
What kind of fishing? Like, you'd take a dinghy out, or did you go spearfishing there?
Yeah, we went spearfishing when we were a bit older, but yeah, we always had tinnies and well, the old man always had a big boat that we went off reef fishing with.
And you can surf in Gove as well.
Yeah, you can if you're silly enough, like we are. But yeah, only when cyclones roll through, really. And yeah, it was a bit silly surfing in Gove, but same as diving, I guess. But there's crocs absolutely everywhere. But yeah, there is. Whenever cyclones or big winds come through, you can catch a wave every now and then. It's not very often though.
Did you ever see a croc when you're out surfing?
Not while I was out surfing, but I did see one. One popped up away from me, about 5 metres away from me when I was spearfishing. And, yeah, I heard everyone, my mates yelling out to me on the boat, and they're like, "Croc, croc." And I was like, "Oh, God." Yeah, so I just started paddling. And they reckon, oh, it wasn't that big. It was only 3 metres.
Oh, wow.
I just nearly... Yeah, I couldn't believe it. Yeah, nearly 3 metres. Yeah, no worries, mate. Yeah, still big enough to have a bite.
Oh, absolutely. Far out. Oh, you did well to get out of that one unscathed.
Oh, well and truly, yeah.
Not sure if that's brave or stupid. That was Harry Pitkin from Gove, which is in northeast Arnhem Land over in the Northern Territory. And it sounds like a pretty cool place to have grown up in, apart from all the crocs in the water. Between bull riding, being a station hand and working as an electrician in the Pilbara, Harry Pitkin has certainly lived a few lives for someone who is only 23, and he's about to head to Canada to see what it's like working on ranches over there. I'm very jealous. It's always good to head overseas and see how they do things over there and maybe learn a few things or two and bring that knowledge back home. If you tune into the Country Hour tomorrow, you're going to hear from another young self-starter about how he ended up as a research scientist up in Kununurra. It's always great to hear the stories from young guns who work in the ag space here in the north. So make sure you tune into the program tomorrow from midday. As for now, it is off to the newsroom. Thank you so much for your company on the Country Hour today. I hope you enjoy New Year's Day. Take care. I'll catch you tomorrow, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.